Ni hao, konnichiwa, annyeonghaseyo, hola, hello, what's up? My name is Caleb, and I'm here with William, Jihao, and Zhangyang, all a part of Los Angeles Public Library's Chinatown Branch Oral History Project, together with our producers at ConnectoPod. The Oral History Project is a teenager-led project based in LA's Chinatown, focused on raising awareness of the negative impacts of gentrification in the neighborhood. Today, we're joined by Vice President of the Chinese Historical Society of SoCal and longtime activist of Chinatown, Eugene Moy. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever and whenever you are. My name is Caleb Leong, and I'm joined by
Chihao Huan.
And my name is Zhangyang Wu.
My name is Malia Mahalona Janelkarn.
And we're all from the Chinatown Teen Council interviewing.
I am Eugene Moy from the Chinese Historical Society of California and a native of Chinatown.
Here in the Chinatown Branch Library. Would you like to tell us about your history?
Well, as I indicated, I was born in LA Chinatown at the French Hospital, which unfortunately is not open as a hospital anymore. I wish it was. It's a type of change that some of us who were born there, who grew up here, really wish we still had.
What do you do here in Chinatown?
I'm here in Chinatown almost every day, even though I don't live here. I live in Alhambra. But this is my home community, and I belong to a number of organizations here, and I'm very much involved in the leadership and the day-to-day activities of these organizations. I am currently the president of the Chinese Historical Society of Southern California. I joined in 1976 when I learned about this organization being formed. I'm also a board member of the Chinese American Citizens Alliance, CACA for short. We're a civil rights organization that actually got started in San Francisco in 1895. The LA chapter was started in 1912. I'm a past president. Just yesterday, we had a big photo session for the national convention that's coming up in September. We got all the past presidents together for a big photo. I'm also on the board of the Chinese American Museum, which is located next to Alvera Street. And that was actually part of old Chinatown.
It's the museum. It's free admission, right?
That's the Chinese American Museum is a historical museum, but it's also got a lot of contemporary exhibits. Some of you might have gone over there to see the Boba exhibit.
Yeah. Right?
Okay. I'm also a board member of the Chinatown CLT, Community Land Trust. That's an organization that has been just recently created to look into ways to acquire property and manage it for low-income housing. So I'm involved in a variety of ways here for in support of the community.
Yeah. Well, here at the Chinatown Library, the Teen Council, a recent issue has been gentrification in Chinatown. And I know you've mentioned that you were born here and you've lived here for many years. And you mentioned about the French Hospital closing. And so I was thinking if you can tell us a bit about how you've seen Chinatown change through the years.
So I was born at the French Hospital. That was in 1949. I'm 74 years old. But I didn't live in Chinatown at that time. Many kids who were born here who were Chinese American oftentimes lived in some of the outlying areas in South LA. Our neighborhood was black, brown, and white, sort of mixed. And we were one of the few Asians who were down there. My dad had a grocery store out there. So a lot of times our economic and social environment kind of reflected the political environment, which for a long time was very anti-Chinese and anti-Asian and anti-immigrant. The Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882 was in effect until 1943. That's a period of 61 years. There were other laws against Chinese and other immigrants, whether you were Mexican or Japanese or other backgrounds. So as a person who I still consider myself a relatively young person, I grew up in an environment where there was still a lot of racism, there was segregation. The Brown versus Board of Education court decision was not passed until 1954. I was a five-year-old when schools were desegregated. So you guys have grown up in an environment where maybe you didn't have to experience that kind of racism and attitudes toward minority groups like Chinese. The same thing applied for living conditions in neighborhoods. You couldn't just live in any neighborhood. So I grew up at a time when there were race covenants in deeds to property that people were prohibited from living in certain areas. I grew up in an environment where there was a lot of social change and political change, where having experienced anti-Chinese hate, you know, we had just gone through World War II. I'm what they call a baby boomer. I was born right after the war. And the people who came back from the war, especially those who were in the Pacific, were very, very anti-Asian because they fought a war against Japan. So oftentimes we could be mistaken for Japanese. Yeah. And so people would hurl racial slurs at you. But they also, if they knew you were Chinese, because there's also, you know, a similar resentment or hate against Chinese. And I'm not saying that everybody hated you. We oftentimes lived in our neighborhoods and we got along very well with the others. But there's always going to be an element of the society that finds that it is their role to create hate or to play with people's fears. Communities like Chinatowns developed partly because they were a place that people could feel safe and protected. If you were sometimes limited in your language skills, or maybe you didn't have much economic influence, then you were basically relegated to the poorest part of town, places where people could accept you. The wealthy people, sometimes, you know, there were successful business people or people with money who could still, even though they might have been Chinese or black or whatever, you know, could still live and move within the circles that they needed to. However, if you didn't have the money, then oftentimes you were
trapped.
That's a good term. In a ghetto, you know, in a certain community. So oftentimes when there were important projects like a new train station for LA, Union Station was to be something that combined all the three major rail lines, Union Pacific, the Santa Fe, and the Southern Pacific. And they said, oh, we need a central passenger terminal. So the target that they ended up selecting was Old Chinatown, the Old Chinatown area. People were displaced. So there's an irony in that oftentimes the poorest communities end up being the ones that are displaced. And the irony is that, too, many of the Chinese were involved in building these rail lines. The Sacramento to LA line was completed in 1876 with largely a Chinese labor force. So Southern Pacific got here because of the Chinese, and yet Southern Pacific became involved in the displacement of the Chinese. That's the whole irony, and sometimes the problem that we have when we have a group that looks different from the mainstream image that's in the media.
I just want to know that, like, do you see like a pattern, like, from the old China got like displaced because of Union Station, and what's happening right now, like local businesses got pushed out because of like new development projects come into Chinatown, or like residents got pushed out because their rent got increased. Do you see like a patterns?
So my career was really spent working for cities in redevelopment and economic development and housing development. I got a geography and planning degree. But in my work, I ended up working with the economic goals of the community. And sometimes those economic goals would either ride on the ongoing wave of development, or maybe find a way to really jumpstart things and make a great change. Oftentimes then, in both cases, whether it's the writing the economic market or following the political decision-making process, oftentimes the most vulnerable places are the ethnic communities, like the Chinatowns. So old Chinatown was displaced for the train station. But in our current environment, a lot of our cities, whether it's LA or New York or San Francisco or other communities where there are substantial Chinese communities, the fact that the cities are densifying, they're increasing their densities. There is definitely a need for more housing, as you can sort of see from there's a disconnect between income and the cost of housing. And throw into that equation the fact that there's a lot of mental illness and, you know, psychological needs. That has resulted in a lot of displacement of some of our communities. And so the perception that our communities are gentrifying reflects the rising land economics of our communities, but it also reflects the lack of other options available too. And by lack of options, I mean that there isn't enough creative thinking as to how we can solve the problems. People will just work with the traditional routes, you know, okay, so we find a piece of land and we find the money, you know, go to the bank, and then, you know, we'll build it. But some of the communities, like, for example, our Chinatown Community Land Trust, is definitely looking at different ways of property ownership and property tenancy. You know, how can we have adequate housing at a reasonable cost? Part of the problem is that in this country, property ownership is pretty sacred, and the right to profit from property ownership is also kind of sacred. So it's a very tough challenge to make when you have property investors coming in, property speculators coming in, hoping to make a killing, you know, make a lot of money. What that results in, obviously, is the people who have the least power, the tenants, oftentimes end up getting displaced.
The worst end of the stick.
Right. Where do you guys see yourselves in the economic chain here?
I think my dream is to kind of like go off to college and like make it big, I guess, have like get a stable income, and then try and like come back to Chinatown and like take that what I've learned and bring it back to the community. Because like I think a story that stuck out to me is down on North Broadway, there is a SRO that's owned by like a Chinese guy. And then we went there with CCED, and they were like the tenants there, they got their clothes thrown out, or like the room caught fire, or like the hallway lights don't work and stuff like that, right?
Yeah.
And I kind of want to like try and like come back, and like with my money, or with like community maybe money, we can like try and get property and make a change. But I don't know, maybe that's like too like green-eyed.
Well, I think it's actually a realistic vision. That's some of the thinking behind our Chinatown Community Land Trust, is that we can organize to raise the funds. So maybe we ourselves individually, the members who make up the board, are not individually rich, but we can find sources of money that can help acquire a property. You know, if we have to get a grant from a public agency or a grant from a foundation combined with a loan from a bank, that's sometimes how you have to do it. When I worked on housing projects in my communities, I retired from El Monte, and before I worked in Southgate and Burbank and Downey and Long Beach. The way you put a deal together oftentimes involves a lot of negotiation, a lot of communication, determining what the need is, you know, what the gap you need to fill, having a good business plan, and working out all of the different numbers, you know, in order to make it work. So let's say you want to build a 50-unit housing affordable housing project. You know that you can only get so much revenue income out of it. So how much do you need to borrow to build that building and then have the rent pay off that? So I think that's part of the vision of our community land trust, is to really attract some capital, use local expertise, as well as having an ethical set of principles in building and renting and managing. That's the problem with, as I mentioned, with our system of land ownership. It tends to reward the people who are going to make the most money, right? You know, and by creating a nonprofit land trust, which has a stated vision of helping the people in the community, that is seen as one way to do it. Another way, though, of course, you know, if I won the lottery or somehow
made a mass fortune somehow,
made a fortune and had a successful business, then yeah, I think I would like to be a humanitarian. I am able to own my own house, but then right now, because of land prices, I couldn't even afford my own house right now, you know, if I really had to buy a home again. But there are people who have capital and who can invest. So we're hoping that with this land trust that we can also get some private investors involved. You know, so if you've got 100,000 or a million or whatever, you know, can contribute, then we'd like to organize a project where we can make that happen. It's really following a certain set of ethics and principles. You know, we really remain true to our vision.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you mentioned like the community land trust. I also like, I'm working with Chinatown Community for Agro Development, CCED, that Caleb mentioned. I also like get to know a little bit about the CLT, the Chinatown Community Land Trust. And I was wondering, like, because, you know, in Chinatown, there's like no grocery store. Like, how possible is it like to bring in a cooperation grocery store that's operated by the tenants themselves and serving the tenants?
Well, a couple of things. One is obviously the vision and having a strong sense of purpose and sticking by it. The other is the practical side of making the numbers work. And if some of you guys are going into math or engineering or sciences, you'll appreciate that business today is accomplished through a complex process. You know, you really need to make sure that the numbers work. I myself have worked on grocery store projects in the past, you know, in working in my cities. One thing that has been very evident is that the grocery business is very complex. A good little supermarket, a small supermarket, might need something like 10,000 items on its shelves. The big supermarkets, you know, like a Vons or Super King or others.
Walmart.
Yeah. Well, actually, the Walmarts are not really
grocery stores.
Yeah. They make their money on volume rather than, you know, variety. They're not the most diverse. But the supermarket industry has been evolving. There has been a lot of mergers and also bankruptcies. So many markets have closed. People will ask, oh, we want an American supermarket, or we want a Ralph's, or we want a Vons, or we want something that has all the things that you want, you know, five kinds of bread, or, you know, 10 kinds of cookies. If you want milk, it's got to be the low fat or non-fat, or you got
dairy free.
Yeah. So it's very difficult to manage a complex process. You know, you have to have the supply chain that provides all of that, and then you have to have the consumer market that can purchase those things. The success of a lot of independent companies like Trader Joe's or Sprouts, which have a smaller inventory of things, they don't try to compete with the supermarkets. They don't try to have 10 or 15 or kinds of different things. They have actually been cutting into the operations of the so-called full-service supermarkets. So when Oiwa closed, people were not happy that a company that had been around for a while and had a variety of things you could buy. You know, they had fresh meat case, fresh fish. They had, the shelves were packed floor to ceiling, and you could find a lot of different things. Most markets today are just operate on volume. They don't really have the ability to try to fulfill all of their entire market's needs. When CCED and other folks met with the management of OIWA, they basically felt that all of their other markets were larger, and this one was too small. It didn't have enough volume. It didn't meet their business plan. So what we need to do is to find an operator with a business plan that can accommodate this community. So that's the challenge.
So like we're like a special market, and we need to find something that like it's not like a one size fits all, but we need like a custom fitting solution to like a unique situation that only we have.
Well, really, we have been looking at maybe a corporate model or a single ownership model. In other communities, there are co-ops, you know, so there are other forms of ownership and operation and management that we can look into. With our CLT, we are looking at different ways of ownership. Maybe it could be a co-op form of housing or a different form of ownership. There are some innovative funding programs coming out now that are untried, but that it seems like the federal government and the states are looking at and talking to communities about how to organize to build more housing, because everybody's under the gun. You know, there is a definite shortage of housing. So with the supermarket operation, yeah, we need to maybe have an economic development partnership locally, or do we find a corporate owner that is able to accomplish what we need? So we really have to get into those details. I mean, yeah, you know, we can say, oh yeah, we want a supermarket, but then we have to really ask, what kind of supermarket do we want? And what do we, you know, what is the market that it's serving? Is it serving the Latino market, or is it serving the Armenian market, or, you know, what works well? We hear that some folks in Chinatown will go to Super King up on San Fernando. Who owns Super King? You know, they're Middle Easterners. I think they're Lebanese, I think. But there are many of the same products that we in the Chinese and Asian community like. And by the way, our demographics is changing too. Chinatown is maybe only 50% Chinese. What do we need to provide to make sure that we are able to have the sales that will sustain it? So maybe on one aisle we need this kind of food, and another aisle we need a different kind of food. And our own Chinese community is very diverse. My family is from Guangdong. You know, I don't know where your families are, maybe from different areas, maybe from China, maybe from Hong Kong, maybe from Taiwan. We eat different things. My wife brought home some food for me yesterday. In Alhambra, we have a restaurant called Meat Chin, Q-I-N, and she brought me some spicy noodle lamb dish. She couldn't eat it, but I could eat it, you know. So even within our own community, we are so
diverse,
different, diverse. And we're also more sophisticated too. If you want something that you like, you know where you can go get it. You know, we can go to Alhambra, we'll go to Garden Grove, you know, where's the best pho? We go to Pasadena or Glendale for Zanku, you know, for chicken, you know, because we don't do the same thing every day.
I'm not sure if you have the data, but like, can you kind of like describe the Chinatown is in its demographic, like racial demographic, or like income bracket?
That's a good question. Yeah. Yeah. And that's one of the challenges that we have. It's been shifting. First of all, geographically, Chinatown is maybe about a half mile by 1/2 mile. So math geniuses, how many square miles is that? Half mile by half mile.
That's a good question.
Oh my God. One half times 1/2.
Area equals, you know.
Length times width?
Yeah.
Like 1/4?
Yep, 1/4 square mile, okay? It's a very small area. And in that area, we have maybe, I'm just rounding off, or the census data show that Chinatown has 20,000 population, maybe half are Chinese, 25% Latino. So if you walk out on the street right now and you look at the people who are selling on the sidewalk, you know, who are selling? The Latino guys who are selling off the from the back of a pickup truck, the horchata, you know, or you get sugar cane, you have Vietnamese, you have Cambodian, you have Taiwanese, you know, you go to Tenrin, you know, that's a Taiwanese company. We're a pretty diverse market. Also, the 10,000 people who call themselves Chinese here are only a small percentage of the LA County Chinese population. We might have somewhere between 550 and 600,000 Chinese in LA County. I live in Alhambra, which has 40,000 Chinese. That's four times as many as Chinatown. So that's why Garden Cafe can be open, you know, until 4 a.m. That's why there are dozens of restaurants and stores, and that's why GW Market or 99 Ranch Market and other stores
are able to operate.
Are open, yeah, mm. yeah. Because there is a population there, not just a working class, but a professional class population. So people like myself or my wife, you know, we have... Like
doctors.
Or yeah, we have, yeah, there are much higher economics that can be supported in those areas, in those neighborhoods. In this area, we have a working class population for the most part. So if you are a supermarket operator and an investor, you have to ask yourself, okay, how could I?
How much profit? It's
too hard to make 15% on your investment, whereas they can go to another location and make 50% without thinking.
Right.
I'm just throwing out those numbers, but because I'm sure they're more careful than that. But that's just an illustration of how, because of the fact that we have a low-income community, you know, we have 20,000 per capita income, household income. Yeah. Well, it's not the household income, it's the per capita income, I think. Yeah. But we do have a lot of single-person households.
Well, you mentioned earlier about the housing situation. I wanted to ask, what is exactly this Chinatown housing look like?
Well, Chinatown housing varies from very small. There are still some single family homes here. There's a good number of them up in the hillsides, and especially if you go past Figueroa, you know, I count that as part of Chinatown also on the other side. When I grew up, almost all of the surrounding area here, even on this block where this library was, there were seven single-family homes that were torn down by a developer who bought the land, but then eventually the city for the library. And then by the 1950s, 1960s, 1970s, many of those homes became converted, or rather the properties became converted into multifamily, into small apartment buildings, four units, six units, eight units. But now in the 80s and 90s, and maybe more recently, we're beginning to see 50-unit projects, 60-unit projects, 100-unit, 300-unit projects. The land economics has changed, and that has resulted in higher densities and then greater investment. So instead of a single family home being owned by a local family. When my aunt and uncle moved here from Hong Kong in the 70s, they came here and lived in a one bedroom apartment, and their two sons would live in the living room. They hung a sheet from the ceiling. So one cousin of mine had a sofa, and the other guy had a sofa too. You know, they had. So that was at a time, and then with the war in Vietnam, with many refugees coming, families coming from Vietnam and Cambodia, we also had crowding in that fashion, where many of the old apartment buildings were really quite crowded. But more recently, some of the more higher-end kinds of apartments that are being built, they're really not for our families. That has resulted in a decline in the youth population in Chinatown. That's why Castellar Elementary School has lost enrollment. At one time, when it was at its peak, it had 1,000 students, or over 1,000 students. and was running year-round programs. They were having a summer session too. But more recently, there have been empty classrooms, and the school district has threatened to have a charter school come in. And so that was something that a lot of people were really concerned about. But the solution now is to have a middle school grades come in. It's still nowhere close to the 1,000 students that were there at one time. So at a time when there were many younger families here, that really supported the grocery stores, and that supported the small mom-and-pop restaurants. Now we are in a changing environment. So the term gentrification is more about the rising land economics and all of the impacts that follow. It's not as if there's any group of people sitting around saying, we're going to target this area, which was what happened back in the 1930s when they looked at Chinatown and said, you know, we'll put a train station here and we'll displace all the people. There is a definite need, though, to implement some land use controls. So some of us have been involved in really working with the city planning department in this latest community plan, the downtown LA 2040 plan, that involved planning guidelines for Chinatown by pushing for height and density limits on property. Hopefully that would reduce the amount of land speculation, you know, that people would not just come in from, you know, some rich guy from New York or Paris, or come in and say,
this place,
you know, yeah, we're going to spend $1,000 a square foot for land, and then we'll build a 27-story building and make money. Well, there are challenges. There are some large projects that have already been approved. Sometimes people don't have any choice but to bite the bullet and pay for a lot of money, you know, pay half your income or more for housing.
So since you mentioned the housing rent for the low-income seniors are increasing, could you also share any personal stories or experiences of community organization and resistance against gentrification here in Chinatown?
You know, like with any group that does not know the language of the dominant culture, you know, it's really difficult unless you find somebody to represent you. The example I cited, Hillside Villas, has both a Latino and Asian tenant population. And there has been a need to have some tenant representatives who have skills in both languages. So for the past 2 years, there have been a lot of meetings that have involved the tenant association, so that the tenants themselves have an understanding how they can challenge the unfair rent increases. But like with any kind of effort like that, it involves a lot of some legal processes that are going to be costly unless you find a nonprofit or get free legal help to support you. And even then, when you challenge an existing structure, that you don't always have a good, clean solution at the end. You know, oftentimes it might be some people will lose and some people will be okay. We have not seen any really good examples of successes yet, actually. You know, so I don't want to sound too depressing, cynical, but unless there are some strict controls on how much land value can rise, then it's hard to take away that profit motive from investors.
Thanks for listening to part one of this interview. You can catch the second part on our website, where we continue the conversation with Eugene.